And welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. My next guest is Alec Ross. He's an innovation expert and the author of the New York Times best-selling book, The Industries of the Future, which is just out in paperback. It's about the changes that economies and societies can expect over the next decade and what we and our children should do to prepare for the changing nature of work. For several years, Alec Ross was Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's senior advisor for innovation. He's also worked on the Obama campaign and transition team. He'll be one of the featured speakers at Light City, the Festival of Lights and Ideas that kicks off for the second year on Friday in the Inner Harbor here in downtown Baltimore. Alec Ross, welcome back. Good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
So more than one little bird has whispered in my ear recently that you're contemplating a run for governor. Before we talk about your book, let me ask you to talk about that.
Sure.
That's something on your mind?
You know, I'm giving it some serious consideration. I think that when you think about what's happening in our politics right now, it's absolutely polluted. You know, I was listening to your conversation with Congressman Cummings, and I had my hands on head listening to the things that the Trump administration is doing. And here in Maryland, I'm fairly disgusted by the degree to which Larry Hogan is absolutely refusing to dial back Trump's reach into Maryland. Things like cutting the Chesapeake Bay cleanups from $73 million to $5 million. So we can't just look dispassionately at what's happening in Washington. It impacts us here in Maryland. And so I'm thinking about getting into this so we can get rid of Larry Hogan and put Maryland back on the right track.
Is there a timetable for making an announcement about this kind of thing?
You know, I think I'll be making a decision in the next month or so.
Mm-hmm. Good. Well, we look forward to hearing what that decision is. In your book, you talk about several different fields that you see as the sort of the thing that we're going to be, you know, using to shape our economic future. These are things like robotics and genetics and money and how we change money, cybersecurity, big data, those kinds of things. I wonder, the book's been out now. It's a huge bestseller. It's been out for about a year. Have you revised your list at all, or do those categories remain in your mind where things are still headed? Has anything changed in this year, and has anything changed given the fact that we are now in the era of Donald Trump and what people are calling a sort of populist movement in Washington?
Sure. I think the things that I wrote about in the industries of the future have proven true. You know, things that were a little bit edgy when I first began to write about them or when the book first came out about things like artificial intelligence, we're now seeing that they are, in fact, really powerful drivers of tomorrow's economy, and they are going to significantly shape labor markets. So there's not a comma or a semicolon that I'd revise in the book. What I will say is that following Trump's election, you know, when I think about the scientific and technological drivers of the future, I don't take a utopian view of them or a dystopian view. I don't think the future is going to be either Star Trek or Mad Max. What I do think, though, is that Donald Trump is hurtling us more in the direction of Mad Max than Star Trek. And so, you know, in order to be able to navigate the very difficult changes in our economy, in our workforce, we need leaders who can figure out how the education systems, how our economy is basically mapping to the drivers of that change. And Trump is regressive. You know, for him to bring coal miners around and say, we're going to reopen the coal mines, I mean, that's just – it's disingenuous. And so this clicking your heels together like Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz and saying there's no time like 1955 – it just doesn't work economically. We're always moving forward. And so Trump, I think, is in many respects taking advantage of people's fear of the future.
So in this dichotomy between Star Wars and Mad Max, I guess one of the constants is that we can guarantee it'll never be on Golden Pond, right? I mean, it's never going to be quiet, that changes are going to be dramatic. They're going to come quickly or quicker than we're maybe willing to admit. And they're going to be big. Is that, in fact, a constant in history? Is that a constant that is relatively recent when we think about the IT age? I mean, you know, 20 years ago, we weren't Googling everything we needed to know at an instant. But is the time frame of the changes continuing to get smaller and smaller?
Yes. This is what's so disorienting. You know, change has always happened. But what's happening now is it's happening so fast. Instead of a person getting a job and being able to keep that job for 15, 20, 30 years based on a single set of skills, now people who are graduating from college have to anticipate that they'll probably have 20 jobs in 30 years. And over the course of the next 30 years, they're going to have to learn new skills half a dozen times because the old ones are obsolete. So it's really disorienting. The pace of change is what's so different today versus what it was years ago.
Alec Ross is the author of The Industries of the Future. He joins me today here in Studio A on Midday. I'm Tom Hall. We'd love to have you be part of our conversation as well. You can give us a call at 410-662-8780. That's 410-662-8780 to join our conversation. If you want to drop us an email, midday@wipr.org is the address to use. And if you want to send us a tweet, our handle @MiddayTomHall. So you and I have a mutual friend. She's a neighbor of yours, Julia Marchari Alexander. She's the director of the Walters Art Museum. We were talking about this book yesterday when I ran into her at an event, and she said that, you know, what interested her about your list is it didn't include what she calls front of house industries. What you're talking about is what we talk about in show business as, you know, behind the scenes, back of house, right? Front of house, the lobby and the seats where people are sitting requires a whole bunch of people too. How do you respond to that?
You know, I think it's interesting. I think that certain of these roles in society and in the workplace are timeless. So I think a lot of the changes that are going to take place economically do, in fact, take place sort of, as you characterize it, in the back of the house. What I do think is that tomorrow's leaders are going to have interdisciplinary skills. So it's not all about science and technology. You know, sure, if you have a good background in science or technology, you can get a good middle-class job. But if you want to know who tomorrow's leaders are going to be, it's going to be people who oftentimes combine an understanding of things that are technical, but combine that with things like emotional intelligence, communications abilities, things that we associate with the humanities. And so I think going beyond tomorrow's jobs, but tomorrow's leaders are going to be people who combine, let's call them front of the house and back of the house skills.
Technology itself is often blamed for people attenuating those human skills, those social skills. I remember talking to Police Commissioner Kevin Davis about the very young police force that he oversees. And he says these are young people who grow up on Facebook and on Twitter and on Instagram, and they have terrible interpersonal skills often. So they're actually training young police officers how to, you know, simply have conversations with people that are not, you know, animated by your thumb. Is that a continuing danger as well? I mean, the fact that we do so much electronically, we do very little the way you and I are talking.
Huge danger. It makes me so sad when I go into a high school cafeteria during lunch, and I see dozens of young people sitting on the benches together, shoulder to shoulder, and they're all looking at their cell phone as opposed to talking to each other. I can't help but think that that is unhealthy. It's emotionally and intellectually stunted. And I do think that also the total immersion in technology that people have from such a very young age, I actually think it's impacting the way that people communicate. It's impacting the way that people learn. It's impacting our attention spans. And so this is why I don't take a utopian view of this technology. It does a lot of good things, but I also think it does some very bad things. And this is a case where, as a parent, I have a 14-year-old son, a 12-year-old daughter, and a 10-year-old son. My wife's a sixth grade teacher in Baltimore City Public Schools, and the two of us have to work really hard to keep our kids from just being subsumed by this technology and having it reshape the way that they socialize.
Do you have like electronics-free zones in your house and
The Wi-Fi does not extend through the house. That's purposeful. So if you're going to be on the Wi-Fi, you have to be in a certain part of the house. Cell phones do not go into bedrooms. So, you know, if you're not going to go to bed and sort of have the last interaction you have with the world be on your phone. And then we do limit time on technology. And so to the extent possible, we limit the time, though we get in big fights about it, and we oftentimes lose those fights. And then try to make sure that what they're doing online is healthy, you know, playing chess, learning Chinese, communicating with their friends rather than just sort of mind-numbing games.
It's been a while since I've had kids who are the age of your kids, but it just seems to me, you know, a kiss goodnight, and by the way, let me collect your cell phone.
I mean, I just don't think of that. This is welcome to 2017, parenting stuff.
Alec Ross is my guest. He's the author of The Industries of the Future. 410-662-8780 is the number. Midday at WIPR.org is the email, and at Midday Tom Hall is the Twitter handle. Let's go to the phones. Alan in Central Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Alec Ross.
Thanks for taking my call. Mr. Ross, a question regarding your thoughts on with artificial intelligence likely to take over more and more non-routine cognitive type of work. What are your thoughts on the likelihood of this country moving towards a universal basic income model?
So universal basic income, everybody is guaranteed a certain amount of money, whether they're working or not. This is something that's in place in several European countries. What do you think?
I think that's an excellent question. I think it's very unlikely to happen in the United States until we see unemployment three times what it is right now. And the reason for that, bluntly, is that we are a much more individualist than collectivist society. So if you think about the response to Obamacare, for example, people were so up in arms over Obamacare, in part because it was, I think, inherently collectivist. It reshifted the burden for paying for health care from wealthier people to less wealthy people. And it very nearly cost Barack Obama his presidency. Now think about a universal basic income. Multiply Obamacare by like 50. So you can imagine how difficult it would be politically to get something like that through the American people, through the Congress. So while it is taking root in certain European countries, that's because of their culture, because of their inherent collectivism, as opposed to the individualism in the United States and the very different politics we have here. So maybe sometime, but not until unemployment is at least triple what it is today.
In your book, you were kind enough to count all of the things that go into a human body. And for those of you who haven't taken the trouble like me to count, I can tell you that 78 organs, there are 206 bones and 640 muscles, according to Alec Ross. And you also say that the world's last trillion-dollar industry was computers and computer code, and the next trillion-dollar industry will be created out of genetic code. That's very interesting for Baltimore in particular, which has a number of genome projects going on. What's that going to look like, this next trillion-dollar industry and genetic code?
This could be a very, very big deal for Baltimore and for Maryland. As I said, the last trillion-dollar industry built out of computer code, the next trillion-dollar industry is going to be based on harvesting data from the 20 to 25,000 genes that exist in all of our bodies, and then being able to do things like new diagnostics and new medicines that map to who we are specifically at the individual DNA level. So right now, personalized medicine basically is a doctor figures out what's wrong with you, prescribes one or two medicines. If you're heavy, you get one dose. If you're skinny, you get another dose. That's personalized medicine. It is going to be possible in 5 or 6 years such that when you go to the doctor, they take a sample of your genetic material, they sequence it, they figure out exactly what's wrong for you, and a precision medicine, a pharmaceutical, is printed specifically for who you are genetically and for the specific genetics of your condition. What holds this back in the future is actually less the science than the way that we regulate drug making. But it's going to be technologically possible very soon. And I think it's probably going to add upwards of 5, 6, 7 years of life expectancy to people who are under the age of 40 today.
And the ramifications of that are just multifaceted. We already have a tough enough time caring for the large number of seniors as the baby boom generation gets older. We have more people living over the age of 100 than ever before. When we talk about health care, the large majority of health care expenses go to people in that age category, the senior age category. But also the bioethical dimension of this. I mean, Jeff Kahn, who runs the Berman Institute for Bioethics at Hopkins, is a regular here on Midday, and we talk about this all the time. I mean, this raises questions we never even thought we'd have to ask in the past.
Designer babies. So there's a brilliant, brilliant scientist who got us started, Johns Hopkins, named Luis Diaz. And when I was interviewing Dr. Diaz for my book, The Industries of the Future, I said, what's the downside of this? This is really exciting. My kids can live longer lives. And he said to me, he goes, designer babies. He goes, right now, he goes, I can tell by testing the genetic material of a baby still in utero, not born yet. He goes, I can give you a very precise set of data about the percentage likelihood that that child still in utero will grow up to become an alcoholic or grow up to have Parkinson's, whether it'll have blue eyes or brown eyes. And with some of the kinds of things that we can do genetically, we can repair some of the malfunctioning DNA. We could take the likelihood that somebody is going to get Parkinson's and take it from 12% or 2%. And, you know, nobody would argue against doing something like that. But what if the mother says, oh, brown eyes, I wish my baby to be had blue eyes. You say he's likely to be 5'8", 5'9". Could we make him a little taller? And so the idea that we could do gene editing to babies still in utero to basically be able to design our future humans absolutely unearths an enormous number of ethical questions.
I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. By the way, coming up tomorrow, music icon Judy Collins joins me to talk about her long career and a new CD. It's called A Love Letter to Stephen Sondheim. Then theater critic J. Wynn Russick will be here with a review of Twisted Melodies. That's a one-man show at Center Stage based on the life of the 70s soul singer and composer Donny Hathaway. My guest for the hour today is Alec Ross. He's an innovation expert and author of The Industries of the Future. We'll have more with Alec Ross when we return from a quick break. We'll take your calls, your questions, and your comments. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Glad you're with us. Stick around.
This is your NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Alec Ross joins me today in Studio A. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Industries of the Future. It's now available in paperback. He's a distinguished senior fellow at Johns Hopkins University. He served in the State Department as senior advisor on innovation to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. And he also worked in the Obama campaign and transition team back in 2008 and 2009. If you have questions for Alec Ross about the industries of the future, you are welcome to pose them here. 410-662-8780 is our number on Midday. Our email, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Cybersecurity has been much in the news ever since the election, and certainly during the election last fall. You talk about how the first hacking happened in 1903, where somebody sort of hacked Morse code. So this is nothing new. And you talk about the weaponization of code. There are different kinds of cyber attacks that can happen. One is called denial of service attacks, where they just sort of shut down the network. Can you rate for us, in your mind, the likelihood or the severity of the risk of having the electrical grid for the Northeast United States break down, or the banking system break down because the computers have been hacked by a malicious party?
Yeah. So I think that, first of all, I think the weaponization of code is the most significant development in conflict since the weaponization of fissile material. The difference being that creating a nuclear arm requires access to the scarcest of scarce scientific talents and transuranium elements, whereas creating a very, very powerful malware has a much lower barrier to entry. I think it's fairly unlikely, at least over the short term, that we're going to see electrical grids turned off running down the eastern seaboard. But I think banks are significantly more vulnerable. I spent a lot of time in that charmless windowless room known as the White House Situation Room while I was in government, being witness to the attacks coming against the United States. And the problem with the banking system is that it's where the money is. And so the Russian hackers in particular put an enormous amount of effort into getting inside of our banks. And they've actually done a very good job of getting inside the banks. What they haven't been able to do yet is get outside the banks with our money. In 2014, in the summer of 2014, Barack Obama was getting daily briefings about a cyber attack against seven of the country's largest banks. And the worry, obviously, was that accounts could be manipulated. You went to bed thinking you had $4,000 in your checking account. You wake up and you have $400 and no way to get it back. I do think the banks have gotten religion and are taking this issue very seriously, but it's absolutely impossible to be calm and collected about this if you actually know how weaponized cyberspace is.
And are the actors in this state-sponsored actors? I mean, do we fear the most from China, from Russia, from North Korea, or is it that 400-pound guy in New Jersey that the president alluded to in during the presidential campaign? Are there individual actors? Are there groups like ISIS, people who are specifically doing it as a terrorist thing, perhaps not even for financial gain? I mean, what's the list of severity of that when it comes to that?
So the most powerful cyber armies are they either work for governments or they're closely aligned with governments. I mean, the most powerful are the United States, the UK, Israel, Iran, China, and Russia. Those are sort of the most powerful actors in this space. China really doesn't have any incentive to turn the lights out in the United States. If stock price plummets, they lose too.
Because they're so heavily invested.
That's exactly right. The most problematic actor here really is Russia, because Russia is really disconnected from most of our global markets and global norms at this point. And so the biggest problem comes from hackers who either work for or aligned with the Russian state. Now, there's a whole layer of actors beneath them, like North Korea and others, who actively try to undermine our economy, actively try to steal our intellectual property. But the most powerful malignant actors do come from Russia. And in terms of non-state aligned actors, the proverbial 400-pound guy in his basement that Donald Trump referred to, they cause a lot of problems, but they tend not to have the capabilities that rooms of dozens of very powerful actors working through sophisticated networks can use.
So in terms of public policy, perhaps you could be making the argument that the more marginalized Russia is, the more marginalized even smaller states like North Korea are, the more incentive they have to place attacks, that if we can somehow figure out a way of bringing them into the fold, and this seems to be at least partially behind the approach that the Trump administration is allegedly going to take, what is your recommendation, your prescription for public policy to combat this and to ultimately lessen the threat?
I think this is like nuclear power in the 1950s and 60s and the creation of nuclear arms. For the longest time, the United States did not want to do treaty making for nuclear weapons because we had all the power. We were in a position of advantage in the asymmetrical balance of nuclear power. But then more and more countries were getting access to nuclear weapons. Russia, the USSR, was growing much more powerful. And we finally got to the point where we said, all right, well, let's get into a treaty-making regime. Let's make sure we don't blow ourselves up. We, the United States, do need to get to the point where we start making treaties and are willing to make treaties in the cybersecurity space that have real teeth to them. And for the longest time, the United States was not willing to do so. But I think that there are enough other powerful actors out there that we do need to do some norm setting and some rule setting. As to the Trump administration on this, I don't find them to be at all credible on this, because I find that, if anything, Donald Trump is working for Vladimir Putin more so than he's working for the American people. And so I actually would not trust him to engage in any kind of treaty making with Putin.
Alec Ross, the book is called The Industries of the Future. You're listening to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. 410-662-8780 is how you can join us if you want to drop us an email, midday@wipr.org, or a Twitter, our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Let's go to the phones. Flip in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Alec Ross.
Hi. I just have a quick question about the ethics around designer babies. I think we take it at face value all the time that there's this great ethical quandary there. I was wondering if you could maybe discuss the top three big issues around that, and also kind of the inevitability of designer babies. I mean, it strikes me as something that's going to happen either way, and how do we prepare for it? Thank you.
Thanks for your call, Flip. You know, designer babies was a very popular conversation when we had it with Jeff Kahn from the Berman Institute of Bioethics. I mean, this is something that people really do have, but a lot of people think what Flip is thinking, which is, look, somebody's going to do this.
It's already starting. And so, ethical quandary number one: could this further exacerbate inequality? So ethical quandary number one is, these are very expensive procedures. This is a very, you know, this is something that only extremely wealthy people are getting into initially. And would we have a society where wealthy people are engaging genetically with their babies in the embryonic state, but other people's aren't? Other people aren't. That seems like something out of science fiction, but I actually think that this is how it'll progress.
Well, we talk about haves and have-nots. People could have not just money, but they could have health, and the have-nots could have not only not money, but not health.
And I think this is also going to be the case with precision medicine. So, you know, until health insurance companies pay for these things, the first adopters of these technologies and of these pharmaceutical developments are going to be the very wealthy, people who don't care what the pill costs. They just want to get better, and they've got plenty of money to pay for it. So a lot of these developments, I think an unintended consequence of them will be exacerbating inequality. The second thing that I'll point to is geography. Let's say Europe and the United States decide to play by a certain set of rules. We say, all right, well, you can do gene editing if it lowers the likelihood of disease, or if it will help the baby, you know, live, but not do cosmetic things. You know, the problem here is that there will be other countries around the world, maybe China, maybe Singapore, maybe Malaysia, where they would view this as a market opportunity. They'll say, aha, the United States and Europe are going to heavily regulate this. We are going to make ourselves the HQ, the headquarters, where you come to, where you get the procedures done to develop the baby that you want. There are 196 countries on planet Earth, and getting 196 health systems to play by the same rules would be very tricky.
Kathleen in Towson, welcome to Midday with Alec Ross.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. What's on your mind?
I was calling. I read something recently about, I'm a lawyer and not practicing right now, but a stay-at-home parent. But that's something that I did for years in terms of doing research online and writing briefs, is something that can be possibly phased out, because it's another piece of technology that's really becoming, people will not be always needed. With law, for example, as a traditional career, are there things in terms of careers in the future that you could transition to?
Good question. Piece in the Wall Street Journal, I think today, talking about BlackRock, a big investment firm in New York, outsourcing some of their investment decisions to robots, to computers.
It's wild. I mean, what artificial intelligence is doing is it's not just substituting labor that is manual and routine, the work of men with strong shoulders working in ports, factories, mines, or mills, but it's increasingly substituting labor that's cognitive and non-routine, the work being done by people wearing suits going to work. And so I do think that adaptability is enormously important. And what I would say is, you know, putting aside what the future job or jobs may be, the most important thing here is to be a lifelong learner. the idea that you finish school when you're 18 or 21 or 25 after grad school, those days are over. So, you know, we're always going to have jobs. And in fact, AI may ultimately not be a net, may not produce a net decrease in jobs. We don't know. But what I do know is that if you aren't a lifelong learner, you're going to be in trouble because what you graduate from high school or college with is not going to sustain you through 30 or 40 years of employment, most likely.
I only have about a minute left. A year ago last summer, I found myself very happily in Tallinn, Estonia. I got off the plane, and as we walk down the hallway of the terminal, we see all these posters and signs that brag about the fact that the fastest internet in the world is in Estonia, and you should come here and have your business here and raise your family here. It's a great place to live. How are we going to be creating, you talk about this in your book, the next Silicon Valleys, the next Tallinn, Estonia, is where people have access to this, you know, very, very advanced speed and technology.
Well, the first thing we have to do is focus on our education system. So the reason why Estonia is as thriving as it is today, you want to know where it got started? It got started with public education. They developed a generation of kids who started school at age 5, 6, 7, and by the time they were 18, 19, 20, they were proficient in computer science. They were technologically literate. They were literate in English. And so the honestly, if you want to solve this for the long term, and if you want to make sure it's not just wealthy people, but people from working class or low income communities who can be a part of this, K through 12 education, that's the best place to start.
Estonians have 100% school enrollment and literacy. Interesting. All right. Alec Ross, he's an innovation expert and the author of The Industries of the Future and a distinguished senior fellow at Johns Hopkins University. Appreciate it, sir. We'll see you soon.
Thanks for having me.
Light City begins here in Baltimore on Friday. Alec Ross and Dr. Freeman Hrabowski, the president of the University of Maryland Baltimore County, will be appearing together at Light City a week from today. Their topic will be a path to the future for young people. We'll have more information and a link at our website, wipr.org/midday. That's it for us today. Tomorrow on Midday, the one and only Judy Collins. She's going to be appearing at the Columbia Festival of the Arts this weekend, and she will be my guest here on Midday tomorrow. As well, J. Wynn Russick, our theater critic, will be here. She'll have a review of Twisted Melodies at Baltimore Center Stage. Lunch today was provided by the Baltimore Chef Shop on the Avenue in Hamden, offering a variety of private events and cooking classes for kids and adults, including baking and international cuisines. Tomorrow evening at 6:30, they're offering a Thai street food class. More on the web at baltimorechefshop.com. Thanks for listening. On behalf of the entire Midday team, I'm Tom Hall. Have a great day.